Josh, it's great to have you back on Full Story.
Great to be here.
Steph, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, I'll start with you. You've been looking at Australian music charts. You've been crunching the numbers. What did your deep dive reveal?
Okay, well, it was quite a journey, right? We started off with the question, is it true that Vance Joy's Riptide is just always on the charts? Like, that's the thing we wanted to find out. And then as we just accumulated more and more data, as we were looking at it in different ways and splitting it different ways, we just started coming up with a whole bunch of different things. Like, we started looking at the share of Australians over time, the different genres that are prominent at different times. Yeah, and we discovered that there's been just this massive, I guess discovered is the wrong word. We put a number to this massive decline in the share of Australian music in the annual 100 charts. And we also were looking at like, oh, rock is nowhere near as prominent as it was before. Mm. Country is becoming more prominent, things like that.
Steph, you're The Guardian's culture editor. Did these findings surprise you?
Not at all. I think the fact that there has been basically hardly any Australian music on the ARIA charts is really reflecting what's happening on streaming right now. It used to be that you would listen to new music via radio, you'd find out about it on music blogs or on music websites, music magazines. People don't listen to radio the way they used to. Music magazines barely exist in this country. Music blogs, I don't think they do. So everyone gets their new music now from streaming. Mm. And Australian artists just aren't being heard on streaming at the moment.
So, Josh, I want to drill into some of what you found. But to do that, I want to understand the charts that you were looking at. What were you unpacking? What are charts tracking and calculating these days?
The first thing we did was we got the ARIA chart data itself, and that goes back to about 1988. But the history of Australian charts goes back a lot further. It goes back to about the 60s, depending on what you consider a chart. For quite a long time, it was basically run by just one person. But then, you know, it changed over time. Industry groups took over, or some radio stations and TV stations took over as well. So it has evolved over time. For about 37 years, the ARIA chart has been the most prominent one, which is run by the record industry.
And is that physical sales in store? Is it listens on apps? How is that tracked?
So again, that has also changed quite a lot. If you go back, it was actual physical purchases in stores. And as I talked to experts, as I talked to people in the industry, they were telling me how there actually used to be a whole bunch of shenanigans around this. You know, if a particular record label wanted to push an artist, they would get people to go into stores and buy albums. But over time, it is now mostly tracking actual plays on streaming services. Mm. The number of streams in Australia has gone up about 50% over the last couple of years. And this is one of the things we found, is that the Australian content has not gone up nearly as much as that. It's barely up.
Steph, if I ask you what was the golden era in Australian music, what comes to mind?
Oh, I think everyone's going to have their own answer for that. I actually started as a music journalist when I was 20 years ago. And I think that era is very, very beloved for people of my generation. At that time, I was a music blogger. I was writing about MP3s and uploading them to MP3 blogs. I don't know if anyone else remembers that particular era. Then I became an editor of a music magazine, a street press in Sydney called The Brag. They barely exist anymore as well. But that was when I was listening to the most music. And as a music editor, I would get sent maybe 20, 30 CDs a day. And the goal would be to try and listen to them all and decide which ones to cover. It's such a different industry now. I just do not think people listen to full albums the way that they used to then. But back in that day, like the album was king.
Yeah, yeah. Josh, what did your data show us about when Australian artists were, I guess, at their peak on the charts? Who was charting?
There's a couple of different ways of answering this question, right? We could just go share of the ARIA chart itself, in which case it's probably like the 90s, especially the early 90s. There's about a third of the whole chart is Australians. But actually, if you go forward about 10 years, so early 2000s, that's actually when a lot of the confluence of a lot of these factors that Steph was talking about before, you know, you had a lot of the music magazines, you had radio stations, you also had things like compilation albums, you also had Australian Idol. And if you look at right in the beginning of the 2000s, you have 3 years in a row where an Australian is number one on the annual chart, and all three of them were Australian Idol contestants. So yeah, it depends on how you define it. I think for me, most people listen to music from when they were like 18 or teenagers. Mm. So I guess that's the answer for me, which is also, 2000.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because your piece said that the peak representation came in 1992 when the charts featured 15 Australians out of 50. And then there was only 5 Australians last year, which is massive, massive difference. How has listener taste changed? What genres are being represented?
Okay, so this is a really fuzzy question to answer because what is a genre is probably something that entire PhDs are being written about. But yeah, if you go back to the 80s, 90s, there's a lot more guitars and drums. There's a lot more rock music there. And then that also coincides with some of the things we're talking about, like John Farnham and stuff like that. Powderfinger even later on than that. But more recently, there's been an increase in country music, and you also have like crossover things like Beyonce or Post Malone. So we are getting, Guns N' Roses back, but across the entire series, across the entire 37 years that we looked at, pop was like a solid half. And then there's just playing around the edges with everyone else.
Genre is such a difficult thing to talk about as well because there's just been a kind of collapse in subcultures, right? So it used to be when I was listening to music 20 years ago, there was indie kids, there was the dance music kids, there were the pop music kids. Now it's all sort of this context has collapsed.
Eclectic mix.
Yeah, and that's why you hear pop music on Triple J all the time and some old people get angry at it, but that's just how it works now. So I also think there's been a bit of a shift in how people create music. Mm. It's quite expensive to try to make music as a rock band. You need not only all the gear, you also need, 4 or 5 people in the band. You need to have band rooms. We've seen band rooms closing all over Australia. We did a feature on Zen Studios, which closed just a couple of weeks ago. Band rooms, it costs a lot of money to pay the rent, to keep a band room going. There's a lot of gear involved. And so to create rock music, you also want to be able to play that rock music, which means you've got to practice it. That's what the band room's for. You've got to record it. Mm-hmm. Really expensive to record it. So a lot of people are just recording their own music that they're making using software on their computer, and the software will imitate the sounds of the band. So they might be able to create a song that sounds like a rock band, but they don't know how to play it live.
Mm, that's a really good point, Steph. You mentioned also that at the heart of all of this is discoverability. And I guess, we're not sitting around watching Rage TV on a Saturday, Sunday morning, nor do people sit and watch MTV and Channel V and get the same kind of music videos at the same time. Is that making it harder to discover artists?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to discover new artists now. And I mean, for the musicians, it's quite heartbreaking. So Creative Australia found that only 8% of the top 10,000 artists streamed in Australia in 2024 were Australian. That's such a small amount. It used to be that the radio stations that we would get music from, like community stations like Triple R or FBI Radio, but predominantly Triple J, that's where we get the new music. They had content quotas. So they have rules that say they've got to play a specific amount of Australian music. The streaming companies do not have those quotas. If they did, we wouldn't know about it because they do not make anything transparent.
It's not just that the places that we are listening to music have changed. There are other factors as well. Like one of the things that popped out at me when I started looking at the charts is Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls. This is a song that first hit the chart, the Australian chart, in 1998. And now it's been like 5 years in a row it was back on the charts. And I was really puzzling, where did this come from? Why is this suddenly so popular? Another one which is known as old is Sunflower by Post Malone. That's been in the chart for like 5 or 6 years in a row. And one of the things both of those hint at is the influence of popular culture. So Post Malone, that song was in Spider-Man. That was the theme song for that movie. Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls, that is actually a very popular track used on the background in like Instagram and on TikTok. So it's not just that we're now listening to more music through streaming services. We also are hearing music through other venues like movies and TV shows, and that's also influencing what we then go try and find on streaming services and listen to.
There's been a really, really recent example of this on TV. An Australian artist called G Flip had their song Bed on Fire soundtrack a very, very big moment in an extremely viral show called Off Campus. Mm. And their monthly listeners went up 230% after that. They told The Guardian it changed their life, which is pretty huge because G Flip is a pretty big export for Australia already. So, moments like that, they're called sync deals, when they get on a very popular TV show, it can have a huge impact because they can suddenly reach a lot more listeners who then will discover their whole back catalogue, and hopefully Spotify will feed them more Australian music off the back of that, but we don't know.
And this is also where a lot of Australian musicians break through, is by sort of piggybacking on these other cultural artifacts, right? They get into TVs, they get into movies, or they are featured on a track by a more prominent musician from overseas. Like the Kid Laroi and Justin Bieber has been on the charts for a number of years in a row now. And that was, I wouldn't say piggybacking, but that's, you know, you're getting a leg up from a more established artist.
We have an interview coming up with Temper Trap. I don't know if you remember them. They've been on hiatus for about 8-10 years, huge Australian export, but they haven't released an album in a while. They have one coming out soon. And one of the singers in the band told us that part of the impetus to record a new album came because a cover of one of their older songs went viral on TikTok. And that just shows you how much of an impact this can have. It got the band back together.
Steph, what if streaming companies were required to have a quota?
I mean, I think that would be incredible if they were. But at the moment, it's actually not a big focus for the advocacy groups. At the moment, all they want is more transparency about the data. We can't have a local content quota on streaming platforms until we understand what is getting played on streaming platforms and how the algorithms work. And they're not giving any of that information up. There's no transparency. So at the moment, a lot of industry bodies are just asking for more accountability, more transparency, and more governance.
Josh, you spoke to a couple of experts in this space who talked about what we lose when we lose the Australian artist, the stories, the accent. What did they tell you?
There was a story a couple of, like, maybe last year about how Bluey had become so successful in the United States that, like, people were having problems with their kids speaking with Australian accents.
Mm.
I think this is a really cogent example of, like, how powerful culture like this is. We need these kind of venues to tell our stories, or even just so we can hear ourselves, right? Like, a lot of the music on our charts comes from America.
Mm.
And we can empathize with the stories of people coming from America and their life experiences, but they aren't us. It's a different thing. And I think losing our, like, sense of identity that comes from this kind of culture is a huge thing to lose, right? Like, that's what's being threatened by not having Australians as prominent as even though they used to be.
If Australian artists are finding it hard to find Australian audiences, that means they're finding it doubly hard to find audiences overseas. Mm. And that means we miss out on that beautiful feeling you get when you're traveling and you go into a shop and you hear Courtney Barnett's Aussie accent and you just go, oh, it's like a little message from home. And I love those moments.
Steph, you mentioned a moment ago the various ways that culturally things have changed, the decline in magazines. What are some of those barriers that are limiting local artists from being discovered by audiences?
Yeah, so we've talked about the fact that we don't have the loyal audiences for radio stations anymore. We've lost a lot of music TV shows, music websites, music magazines, record stores are closing. The other thing that's happening is it's harder and harder to gig. According to APRA AMCOS, COVID wiped out 1,300 small and mid-sized venues, which is about a third of the sector. So those venues haven't come back, and we've lost a lot more since COVID. Rents are so expensive, operating costs are through the roof. People aren't drinking as much as they used to when they go out to gigs, which is a way that venues used to get a lot of the money that they needed to keep operating. Festivals, we've lost a lot of festivals. Festivals used to be a vital way for Australian bands to find audiences. They'd get to gig around the country at Big Day Out. It would give them access to audiences that they didn't have, and they could build fandoms in a way that was just vital. We've lost a lot of festivals. It's become incredibly expensive to run festivals and incredibly risky. The climate crisis, I'm sure we all remember when there were the big floods at Splendour in the Grass.
Mm.
People are a lot more cautious about buying tickets, particularly to multi-day camping festivals. They're going to wait for weather reports before they do it. But on the flip side, the festivals need pre-sales in order to go ahead. And that's why in 2024, Splendour in the Grass and Groove in the Moo both cancelled because they weren't able to sell enough tickets in advance. So when you're losing the live stages, you're losing the festivals, you've lost radio, how are you going to find audiences in a country as vast as Australia if streaming platforms aren't playing your music either?
Just a good example of what Steph's talking about, Amyl and the Sniffers, right? they are a band that has broken through. What happened? Was it last year when they had to cancel their gig at Fed Square in Melbourne? But then they went and played a whole bunch of other gigs around Melbourne at places that helped them break through. Like, those are the spaces that allow this to happen.
And they gave money to venues in order to play there. Yeah, it was an incredible move.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you find out about the band down your street? The way you used to be able to find out is you went to the venue down your street and then you would hear the bands, you know, all the kids from high school bands that are around you. That's sort of has been cut.
There's a venue in Sydney in Dulwich Hill called Lazy Thinking, which this month launched a membership and fundraising model. Like, venues are becoming non-profits basically in order to stay afloat and support the industry. It's pretty extraordinary.
Mm. Steph, being invited to be a support act for a big international band or musician used to offer a chance at a big break for local artists, but even that's not happening that much anymore.
In 2018, Australian artists opened for international headline acts on 57% of major tours. By 2024, that figure had fallen to 36%. So when we're looking at there's less venues, there's less festivals, there's less Australian artists being able to jump on the back of an international pop artist or international rock band, it really reduces their ability to find new audiences. So a few different industry bodies are calling for a national code, which would require local artists to open for every international tour. It hasn't been adopted nationally, but last year New South Wales became the first state to make it a law. And Ballpark Music, an Australian band, was one of the first beneficiaries. It meant that they could land the main support of the Oasis tour, which meant that they performed in front of 300,000 new fans, which is 12 times their existing Australian tour audience. So that's huge. If we made that a policy nationally, it could have a huge impact.
We'll be right back.
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.